I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week we have what may be the quintessential religion and politics story, Paul Ryan's firing of the house chaplain, a Catholic priest. The reasons for Father Conroy's dismissal are in dispute, possibly because he prayed for members of Congress to remember the most vulnerable in society, possibly because some Republican evangelicals think a priest can't relate to the problems of members with families. We'll talk about why Congress has chaplains in the first place, and what this tells us about Catholics in the age of Trump.
We'll also discuss the record number of Hindus running for office in the U.S. this year. In 2016, the Trump campaign was very intentional about its outreach to the Hindu community. But come next January, there could be as many as 8 Hindu members of Congress, and all of them are Democrats.
Finally, we'll review the legacy and work of Dr. James Cone, who died this past week at the age of 79. Cone is best known for developing Black liberation theology, which argued that God is closest to his children who are oppressed. I'll talk about Cone's powerful influence with Elijah Zehu, associate pastor at Calvary Baptist Church in Washington, D.C.
A big thank you to all the listeners who have signed up to support the show as patrons. If you like what we're doing at Impolite Company and think it's important to provide space for these kinds of conversations, you too can help us out by becoming a monthly sponsor. Click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. It's super easy.
If you didn't know yet, and if you don't know, then you're obviously not on Twitter. Nish has returned to Twitter after an absence of several months. That should mean we have no more need for 3 minutes of Nish as our segment at the top of the show, but it's been such a listener favorite, we've decided to keep it. This is the part of the show where she gets time to rant about whatever she wants, but for no more than 3 minutes. Nish, your time starts now.
Oh, Amy, it's spring, which means it's the season for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, or as it's more affectionately known as Nerd Prom. It's the event where media types of all stripes gather with celebrities and elected officials and business leaders and more, and they celebrate each other and honor the role of journalism in the exercise of the First Amendment. And every year, a comedian is hired to, you know, be a comedian. They roast the sitting president. They roast the media. They roast celebrities. The chosen entertainer is always an equal opportunity roaster. Past comedians chosen for the job have been Stephen Colbert, who famously excoriated George W. Bush, who was sitting mere inches from the podium. Samantha Bee, Hasan Minhaj, Seth Meyers, Jimmy Kimmel, Jay Leno, Daryl Hammond, Wanda Sykes, Conan O'Brien. They've all been the comedic act before at the dinner, and they all did their job, which was making fun of the media, the president, and elected officials. That's what they do. This year, the comedian chosen was Michelle Wolf. You may have heard us talk about her. We're fans. And her stand-up on HBO, titled Nice Lady, is cry your eyes out funny. She's crass, she's sharp, she's feminist, she's political, and she's hilarious. She was hired by the association to give a monologue. And she did her job, and she did it well. And there are about 1,000 hot takes right now about her routine, the outrage over her routine, and the outrage over the outrage over her routine. But here's my rant. Stop talking about it. Oh, look, a comedian pushed the boundaries of what's appropriate and what isn't. How the hell is this news and why do we care? She was hired to be a comedian. Comedians make fun of other people. They look at the line of appropriateness, then they push it further out, and then they cross it. They all do. If they're really good at their job, you're laughing really hard while you're shifting in your seat because it's sort of uncomfortable. Why? Because it's likely just a little too close to home and maybe a little too truthful. Political and Media America have lost their collective damn minds over Michelle Wolf doing comedy. For crying out loud, shut up. At the end of her bit, she said, by the way, Flint still doesn't have clean water. It was a pointed criticism at everyone in the room about how they focus on the wrong things. And if the outrage this week is any indication, everyone just proved her damn point. Let the woman live, please, for the love. I'm so tired of talking about it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. That's my rant this week. Okay.
Well, normally I do not piggyback on the rants, but as someone who has attended several of these dinners and who is so happy not to be in DC anymore.
You mean that it wasn't your favorite night of the year, Amy?
No, well, so I should say, I enjoyed my time at the dinners. There was a time in my career when it was kind of a fun way to see a lot of colleagues. You got to get dressed up. I would, this was before Rent the Runway, so I would save my pennies and buy something from Blue Fly and look awesome for the evening, and mostly just hang out and people watch, which is one of my favorite things. And not people watch like the Hollywood celebrities, although that was kind of exciting occasionally. I remember one year where we were kind of stalking the guys from The Wire.
Fair.
We were really into it. Yes.
If Idris Elba was in the same room as me, I would stalk him too.
Yeah, well, Noam was very excited. He thinks that people watching is just stupid, but he wants to be able to actually go and talk to them. So he went over and talked to Marlo Stanfield for a little while, which was awfully cool. And I just hung back and watched. I love Washington celebrities. I am the nerd at Nerd Prom. I think it's super fun to see Madeleine Albright. And before he was elected president, Obama was there one year, and looking around, hanging out with a couple of the people, say my husband, who wrote one of the first magazine profiles about him. So that was kind of fun. That said, it's a horrible event. The actual dinner itself is the very worst part of the entire thing. And, for years and years and years, I have wanted it to just go away because it's the worst sort of everybody sucking up to everybody else. And my worry is that because it is televised and because it has become this thing that gets it, well, but it's not. It's only because everybody who goes there is a journalist. So they all write about it and they all act. It's whenever there's a snowstorm in New York City and that's all you hear for 2 weeks, because everybody who's there is somehow, has a platform to be able to get out the news that, guess what? It snowed two feet in New York City. It's the same thing with the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So it seems like it's this huge event. It's just one night a year. But my worry is that because it is televised, it feeds the perception that this is just how journalists and sources interact all the time. And it really isn't. There may be some people who really have bad ethics and or are just obsequious and you just don't want to be around them. But most people, they're not rubbing elbows with the people that they're covering. And yet this one night a year, I think, does real damage to the trust that is already pretty tenuous among the American public for journalists and for their ability to be objective and to actually tell you what's going on. And because there is this tense relationship between sources and journalists, the comedy part is the most awkward. It was kind of fun during the Obama years because he's actually very funny. I mean, he's got professional joke writers, but he's very good at delivering a joke.
I always preferred listening to the president's monologue than the actual comedian. Even George yeah. W. Bush had some great, some great ones, where they're really funny. You're I would prefer to watch them be funny.
And I am all for making powerful people uncomfortable. Just as a human sitting there, it's a very awkward experience. And we were there for the Stephen Colbert routine. And we left that evening thinking, that was a horrible experience. I had no ability to judge whether it was actually funny or not. And it was only, you know, days later when I came home and I actually watched clips of it all the way through, I was like, oh yeah, those jokes actually, they were quite good. But the experience of being in the room when like several thousand people are just clenched was just kind of horrible. Yeah. So I think it needs to go away. I think it is years past needing to go away. And also then another upside, we wouldn't have to talk about these things anymore and everybody would win.
Exactly. So. And we can just direct our attention and give those people their own Netflix stand-up special where they can do their bit that they would have otherwise said at the correspondence dinner, and we'll all be happier because then we can do it in our pajamas.
Another reminder that you should all have been watching Nice Lady, which is her HBO special. It's so, so very good.
Please, please go watch it because it's so funny. It's so funny. And she has a new Netflix show coming out, a new like talk show, which I'm really looking forward to because I do. I love her. I'm sorry. Sorry, not sorry. Okay. Let's finally dive into our topics for the week. Let's start off with my favorite person in Washington, Paul Ryan. If you thought the House Speaker was going to stop making news just because he's leaving office in November, then you underestimated his ability to annoy people and be the absolute worst. Last week, we learned that Ryan abruptly fired Father Pat Conroy, the chaplain for the House of Representatives, who had been in that position since 2011. It was the first time a congressional chaplain has ever been dismissed from the job.
In an interview with the New York Times, Conroy said he wasn't given a reason for being let go, but that he had received criticism from the Speaker's office and from Ryan himself after he delivered a prayer during debate over tax legislation last fall. So this was his prayer. May all members be mindful that the institutions and structures of our great nation guarantee the opportunities that have allowed some to achieve great success while others continue to struggle, he prayed. May their efforts these days guarantee that there are not winners and losers under new tax laws, but benefits balanced and shared by all Americans. Incredibly controversial there, Nish.
So controversial.
Conroy says that the next time he saw Ryan after this prayer, the speaker told him, Padre, you just got to stay out of politics. And 5 months later or so, he was asked for his resignation.
That's the thing. 5 months later?
That's the thing I find very weird. And I asked this on Twitter. I honestly don't know the answer. I don't know if there are performance reviews for chaplains in the House and the Senate.
Good question. Yeah.
Like there are for most people in most capacities who work in Congress. Not for Congress members, but you could argue election time is their performance review. But, you know, normally if somebody does something that you think is inappropriate, you let them know. Not just on this prayer front, but in the past couple of days, we've heard pushback from Ryan's office saying, no, it wasn't that he, you know, was political. It's just a lot of members were saying they didn't feel comfortable going to him for pastoral care and support, which, you know, there's reporting going both ways about whether that's actually the case. But you would think if it actually was a concern, you would approach him. And, you know, this is a guy who spent 3 decades as a pastor, you know, he might be able to make some adjustments to better serve the members there. But there's no sign that that ever happened. He was just all of a sudden
fired,
dismissed.
Yeah. The whole thing was so, like, the whole thing is still so bizarre to me that this happened and that no one who really knows anything aside from the priest is saying anything. Like, it's all crowded in a lot of shrouded in a lot of secrecy. And I'm like, why? Like, obviously, if it was a fireable offense, you would have no problem coming out and saying, like, yeah, this is why he got fired. I just don't know why Paul Ryan just wouldn't come out and be honest about it, about why he fired him. But one thing I did want to ask you that we kind of said in the intro, I would like to explore a little bit why the House of Representatives has a chaplain. I don't actually know that answer. And I wasn't surprised to learn that they had one. I mean, hospitals have them. There's a lot of places that have a chaplain available to people. So it's not surprising that there is one in the House or in the Senate. I just didn't know. That was news to me. And so I guess did you know what do we know about this role and kind of what they do for the members of the House? What is their sort of pastoral role for people? Why is there a House chaplain? What's the role there? Do you know?
That is an excellent question. So I did used to work in the House and in the Senate. So I was aware of the chaplains. They're most known from their public roles, which is simply opening every session of the House and the Senate chamber with a prayer. And usually it's pretty anodyne. The longtime chaplain in the Senate was a pretty conservative guy, and his prayers sometimes/often reflected that. But they're not figures who you really would notice much. In fact, it was a big deal in the mid-90s. I'm just going to do a little tangent here because it tells you how apolitical this position usually is. It was a very big deal when I was working for Tom Daschle, and we had written legislation that was trying to do the impossible, as I think I've mentioned before on the podcast, trying to square the circle of the abortion debate and make people on both sides happy by drawing the line not at what kinds of procedures can be used to perform abortions, because this was during the debate over partial birth abortion, but the line at when abortions can be performed, before viability by any procedure, and then after viability only in extreme circumstances. Anyway, it was a highly contentious debate, and the chaplain actually came to the floor of the Senate to watch the debate and sit there for the vote. Which he is allowed to do, but really doesn't do. And there was some concern by some members that it was a little bit of, the word bullying is wrong, but it was a religious influence that they felt was somewhat inappropriate on the floor of the Senate, just because it was so out of character and so something that was not associated with that role. So the kind of public part of their role is teeny tiny in terms of the prayers that they give. Mostly what they are doing is simply acting as a chaplain for the institution and its members. So I think in theory, that applies to anybody who works for Congress, and there are tens of thousands of people who work up there as aides, who work in the support offices, but especially for the members themselves. And the idea is that it can be a really stressful role, especially for people who have families, and their families may be back in the home district. They may not have moved to Washington with them. You know, sometimes they may feel really torn about votes that they're taking and just need to talk through the tension between their faith and a vote. They may be going through loss in their lives. I'm pretty sure that Joe Biden has talked about meeting with the chaplain in the Senate after his first wife and his daughter were killed in a car crash. You know, so many people spend so many years of their lives in this job that it really becomes a big part of their lives, and having a chaplain there who they can go to is important for them. The reason we have that, however, isn't really connected to what the role is these days. Apparently, way back in the pre-revolutionary period, well, during the revolutionary period, I guess, the Continental Congress had military chaplains, and it had approved military chaplains for Washington's army and chose a chaplain of its own for the Congress itself. That particular chaplain, the first one that they picked, I believe, kind of got a little political and started favoring Britain at one point. And according to the write-up in the Washington Post earlier this week, he wrote a famous letter to Washington urging him to give up the fight. And for that was exiled back to Britain. So
wow.
apparently Father Conroy, not the first and only example of a chaplain to be disciplined, but the first since the U.S. Congress was officially installed. And it was actually Benjamin Franklin's idea to have the Congress open with prayer, because he thought it was a way of kind of setting the tone to be one of respectful conversation. And so that was kind of just a very small role at the very beginning. And it was later on that the member of kind of, or the membership pastoral role was added, so that members of Congress could meet with the chaplain in day-to-day things. The chaplain, it's important to know for the history, has always been a Protestant, as most parts of American political life have been Protestant, with the exception, as we know, of John Kennedy. But there were only Protestant chaplains until very, very recently. I think the first one was appointed by Boehner about 10 years ago. And then Father Conroy was appointed also by Boehner in 2011. And it probably was not a coincidence that Nancy Pelosi is Catholic, John Boehner is Catholic, Paul Ryan is Catholic. You had some pretty hard-hitting leaders up in Congress who were Catholics and thought now's the time. What is interesting now, and what I had hoped we could talk about for a few minutes, is that at least on the Republican side, there really is this sense that there's our kind of Catholic and then there's other Catholics.
Right, because Father Conroy is a Jesuit.
Yes.
Which is an important item of mention, let's say that. But continue.
Yeah, well, and in this prayer that he delivered during debate over tax legislation, it appears to be one of the only times that he actually inserted a little kind of political nudge. He's taking a stand that is entirely within the mainstream of Catholic thought, that you want to care for the least among you. And
Christian,
that,
just Christian in general, following Jesus.
Right, but when it comes to a state's economy, you should make sure that it's not catering only to the interests of the very wealthy. It has traditionally not been a terribly controversial idea in Catholic thought. But in these days, in these times in American politics, that is considered something that is thought liberal and therefore the province of Democrats.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. Like, I'm like reading the text of what he said again, and I'm like, he wasn't like praying that the Congress would, or that the Congress would stick it to Wall Street. You know what I mean? And like, you know, really stick it to the rich people. He said, "May all members be mindful that the institutions and structures of our great nation guarantee the opportunities that have allowed some to achieve great success while others continue to struggle." Like, honestly, like, let's just be mindful. Like, that's all he prayed. Be mindful of the opportunities here and that there are people who suffer. Just be mindful of that. It's just, I mean, it is so, it's not even like, Oh, these like crazy, you know, liberal snowflakes, for heaven's sakes. Yeah, it's wild to me that that would be seen as extreme, or that that would be seen as political, because it is not just within the realm of Catholic thought that we should be, you know, even just like caring for the poor, let alone be mindful of them. It is like mainstream Christian of all denominations. I mean, frankly, of a bunch of different religious traditions, not just Christian, to remember the poor and to care for the poor. That's a tenet of a lot of different faith traditions. And so for them to be upset that he just said, hey, let's be mindful and just remember. It's like, wow, that escalated quickly. I can't believe you fired him over that.
So not knowing how this went down or why it went down, my suspicion would be that Ryan got some grief, not from his Catholic colleagues, but from his evangelical and mainline Protestant colleagues, who are, because of the faith traditions they are in, not used to religious leaders challenging them on their political actions. And my question is why Ryan would even care, because he's leaving. He doesn't have to kowtow to these guys. And, you know, in that way, it meshes with what we have heard as the other complaint, which is just straight out anti-Catholicism or anti-Catholic, whatever you call it, which is the idea that a Catholic priest, by virtue of being celibate, couldn't possibly relate to and or pastor people who have families. Which has already been picked apart on Twitter, you know, because it means that no Catholic could be the chaplain. But it also implies that no single person could be a chaplain. And I'm betting you none of the guys who are making this complaint would be perfectly happy with a woman as the chaplain, who was a mother and a wife.
Let's not go too far.
They would certainly not think she had the authority to be able to pastor them and counsel them. So this is very revealing about a certain kind of Protestant Republican mindset.
Yes.
What it doesn't tell us is why the heck Ryan would care what they have to say.
Yeah. There was also a really interesting piece in CNN today, and the title is the GOP at risk of losing Catholics? And it talks a little bit about the firing of Father Conroy, but really how there is this kind of new divide within the GOP over the big one is immigration. And how there is a divide between maybe what has historically been perceived as more liberal Catholicism, but really it's not. It's just Catholicism to care for the immigrant and to care for the poor, you know, versus a more conservative side, which, you know, takes a more hardline immigration stance. And I think that, I don't know, as more facts come out, if more facts come out, I don't know at this point. I mean, it's been a couple weeks now since we've found out, maybe. That maybe there's some underlying things at play here regarding kind of the Catholic bloc within Congress, but also just
that's been less than a week-ish.
It's been less than a week because it feels like it's been 5 years. I'm like, oh, it's been 3 weeks since we found out, and you're like, no, it's been 2 days. I'm sorry. Oh, that just made me so sad. Okay. Well, there we go. We should just move on, because then it's like, oh, what else are we going to talk about now that's going to be completely irrelevant in the next 5 hours? Who knows? We might as well get it in while we can. Okay. Let's move on.
So for our next topic, we were interested to see a Religion Dispatches piece last week, which was a great story about the record number of Hindus running for elected office this year. There was some buzz in the last election cycle about Republicans working hard to peel off some of the Hindu vote. I believe Trump called himself a big fan of Hindu.
Yes, that is exactly what he said. Because of course it was.
Oh,
damn it.
But one thing is consistent with this new class of candidates. They're all running as progressive Democrats. They view the Democratic Party as more inclusive, but a few candidates have also voiced concern and opposition to the party establishment, saying that the Democratic Party hasn't done enough to reach out to underrepresented groups and that they have done that at their own peril. So they are kind of an opportunity for and challenge to the party right now.
This was an awesome story to read. I'm actually going to pull it up right now. I loved it. I loved hearing about, you know, why some of them have started to run, why it's been important to them. And just having, you know, some religious diversity and kind of our religion coverage feels really refreshing. But the one piece that really did stick out to me was that opposition to the kind of party establishment. One of them is actually running against a establishment candidate. And, you know, he kind of said, like, yeah, one of the reasons why, like, we've seen what happens. We've seen why, you know, our community should put forward, you know, more candidates that actually represent us and represent who we are. And I found that to be really not surprising at all, because there are those fractures within the Democratic Party that I think we're going to start seeing at a in a very large spotlight here in the coming months. But the fact that it's happening really amongst the Hindu population and them kind of pushing back on the Democratic establishment, I think is probably indicative of the, I don't know, I don't want to call them the fights, but maybe the fractures and the tensions that we're going to be seeing in the coming months within the Democratic Party of who are they actually going to spend their money and their resources and their time reaching out to? Who are they going to be putting on the ballot? Who are they going to put their money behind? And how much? And how much influence are they going to be giving to these people? It's going to be really fascinating to watch. But that was one of the things that I found really interesting, was how much they were pushing back against it. But I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that read in part like a complaint that goes back decades and is really shared by anybody, regardless of their faith background or any background, who goes up against somebody from the party establishment. It's very, very, very hard to break in, or has been traditionally. This may be a year that changes some of those rules. We don't know if it's going to be an exception or if it will be a turning point in which some of those rules start to change as well. But we should note there are currently already 4 Hindu members of Congress, which is itself like a huge change from the centuries of mostly Christian representation. But the question is whether they're going to be joined by 4 more. And I think this is also a story about the rise of Indian Americans. In terms of their clout in business, their clout in pop culture. I just watched a couple of days ago this Comedy Central special by Hari Kondabolu called The Problem with Apu. And it was really fascinating. I highly recommend it. And he had, you know, he pulls together everybody he knows from the entertainment community, which is basically every Indian American that is in the entertainment community, because it's like we all know each other. But just emphasizing the diversity within that community, and the fact that despite their diversity, every single one of them saw the Simpsons character of Apu as the bane of their existence, because it so flattens out a very diverse group of people, and that, you know, what they are spending their careers doing is trying to take that caricature and really turn people's eyes towards a much more inclusive and interesting view of who Indian Americans are, who Southeast Asians are, and now who Hindus and who some Muslim American politicians are as well. So that is kind of a wave that we've been seeing in the last couple decades, and it's really interesting that it is taking a political form now, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, and in this Religion Dispatches piece, Padma Kuppa, who is a progressive activist and Hindu, and she is running for state representative in your home state of Michigan.
In Michigan.
Yeah. She said that democratic values are in general in more alignment with what the Hindu American community prioritizes, specifically education, care for the environment, and fairness. Which I thought was really, I don't know much. I can't say that I know much about the Hindu tradition. We should probably have an expert come on and kind of enlighten us a little bit more. But those are big ticket democratic items. I mean, particularly education and the environment. Like, those are big ones. And so it's interesting to me that there was such a push amongst the GOP to peel off Hindu voters. And I don't know if that was more towards like business and tax type stuff or if it was in some other way. But if what's important to the Hindu community is education, environment, and fairness, it seems to me that, like, I don't know, that would be an exercise in futility for the GOP. I mean, just knowing historically what they're about, and especially in the last, 10 to 15 years, it really seems like aligning with the Democratic Party would be a slam dunk. And so I'm not surprised to see so many Hindus running for office that are Democrats specifically. I would actually be surprised if I saw a Hindu American running as a Republican. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, well, I think some people who covered 2016 may remember this really remarkable rally, and we'll include a link to it in the show notes, because if you haven't seen this, it is something, where Trump appeared before the Republican Hindu coalition in October, so just a month before the election. And one of his largest fundraisers is a man who is Indian American and Hindu, and I think tried to promote the idea that Hindus were big fans of Trump. In fact, reporters who were there talked to a lot of attendees who were like, yeah, no, I was told this was going to be like a entertainment event. And it did go on for hours and hours. And there was a lot of singing and dancing. There was a celebration of Bollywood culture. There was a famous celebrity who was there. They described him here as India's answer to Michael Jackson. So it's possible there was a bit of a bait and switch when it came to the folks who were there trying to make it seem like maybe there were more Hindu supporters of Trump than you might think. But it's really remarkable. I do suggest that people take a look at it, because at the time I was trying to think of what Trump supporters would say about Hillary Clinton if she appeared at an event like that. And we know all of the awful, terrorist supporting attacks that would come out. So, in a way, sometimes it's nice to see Republicans actually maybe trying to open up the tent. But underneath, there's still been a lot of that still xenophobia that I think is never, until that's dealt with, going to make it a permanently welcoming home for a lot of ethnic minorities and religious minorities.
Right. As long as they keep couching their platform in a nationalist, anti-immigration, anti-black and brown people sort of message, any outreach that they do is going to be undermined by all of the policies that they enact and all of the other things that they say and that their supporters say. So yeah, I find that to be the juxtaposition, the cognitive dissonance is pretty loud on that one, if I do say so.
Yeah, well, one of the pieces about the this this rally notes that earlier in the day, Trump had appeared in Maine and given one of his standard campaign lines, which was that he was going to unite the U.S. under, quote, one God. That's something he said over and over, and it was not exactly subtle in 2016. And then just a few hours later appears before a group who worship more than one God.
Many. Like, lots.
And lit a Hindu ceremonial candle and stood up to say, I am a big fan of Hindu and a big fan of India.
He's the worst. Like, I don't even know what to say to that. Like, he's just the worst. We have the worst president.
Agree on that.
Okay. We can always find common ground, Amy, on he's the worst. Okay. Let's move on to our final topic.
For our last topic this week, I called Elijah Zayu, associate pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. Calvary was my church in Washington, and several years ago, Elijah held a months-long study of Dr. James Cone's book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. It's just one of many, many invaluable books by Cone, who may be the most important American theologian of the 20th century. The Cross and the Lynching Tree is a powerful work of theology and history, and it challenges white Christians to examine their faith in the context of American racism and white supremacy. I wanted to bring Elijah on the pod to talk about his experience studying Cone's work and its impact on the social justice work he's involved with today in D.C.
So I was hoping that we could start with you just thinking back about when you first encountered the work of Dr. Cone.
Well, thank you again, Amy, for having me here on the podcast. And I think that I first encountered Dr. Cone when I was a student at Morehouse College. My professors, both in the philosophy department and in the religious studies department, kept throwing out his name. You know, as Dr. Cone says, you know, as Dr. Cone teaches us. And I sat in the first few classes thinking, who is this Dr. Cone? And why is everybody referencing him? And so I got the book, God of the Oppressed, which was his second book. No, it's his third book, God of the Oppressed. And that was my first foray into James Cone. But when I got deeper into it was in divinity school. I studied with one of his students, Professor Dwight Hopkins at the University of Chicago Divinity School, who was in the second generation of PhD students from Union Seminary. And it was through Professor Hopkins that we really explored most of the details of Black theology, and where we read all of the central texts and many of the articles by Dr. Cone and a lot of the criticisms and critiques of Dr. Cone and his Black liberation theology. I would say that, Dr. Cone's work is probably the most important theological work that I have access to in my day-to-day as a pastor at Calvary Baptist Church. The central argument of Black liberation theology that Dr. Cone laid out in really all of his works is that in order to understand anything about God or Jesus Christ in America, we have to understand who the poor and the marginalized and oppressed in America are. And for him, the poor, the marginalized, and the oppressed are Black people. And so he made the argument that Black theology is sort of the lens in which all Americans should see and think about their faith and think about a religious life. Later on in his life, he wrote The Cross and the Lynching Tree, which was the final book that he published in 2011, where he built on these themes and where he made the really strong and compelling case in The Cross and the Lynching Tree that these two symbols, the cross, which is the dominant symbol of Christianity, and the lynching tree, which was the dominant symbol around him when he grew up in Bearden, Arkansas in the 1930s and 1940s, are the ways that we can understand suffering and faith and what a potential path for life together is like for Black and white Americans. And so his theology continues to be something I think we revisit at our church, and that we try to encourage people of all walks of life to try to understand the power and the critique that is in this Black theology of liberation on, you know, the larger white American Christian church and the hope of liberation that it offers.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose the cross and the lynching tree as a text to be studied at Calvary, you know, a multiracial church, and kind of what you were hoping that people could get from that study?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah, we studied the cross and the lynching tree during Lent of 2015. We had our small groups go through it. And the reason we studied the book was, I think, because Dr. Cohn, really wanted people to see this connection between sort of the harm that was done to Jesus and the harm and the terror, really, that Black folks had been experiencing ever since, they got here in 1619. In the preface of the book, in the introduction, he talks about the cross. He talks about not understanding the cross and the lynching tree as sort of what's at stake in Christianity. So he says that until we can see the cross and the lynching tree together, until we can identify Christ with a re-crucified Black body hanging from a lynching tree, there can be no genuine understanding of Christian identity in America, and no deliverance from the brutal legacy of slavery and white supremacy. So for me and for our church, we were striving to be a multiracial congregation, striving to be a congregation that focused on justice. And around the same time, we were having this national conversation about if Black Lives Matter. It was right after the murder of Michael Brown. And so the cross and the lynching tree really stood out as a theological text worth considering for our multicultural body to understand and to try to see, as he called it, sort of the crucified Black body as the body of Christ. And so, you know, we talked a lot in that moment about what it means for somebody like Michael Brown or Trayvon Martin to be seen in many ways as a reflection of like what happened to Jesus as well. And as our sort of access point for trying to make sense of the violent world that I think Jesus lived in, and also the power of transformation that God offered to that world and to our world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the really interesting things, I think, that gets misunderstood a lot from just your average Christian in the pew is the extent to which Black liberation theology is not a message simply for Black Christians, but in fact, maybe even a more important message for white Christians and Christians of all colors, that it's not, although he does address this some, it's not a how do we grapple with our faith given the circumstances that we've been under and the oppression that we've been under, but how do all Christians think about Christianity given this reality in the U.S.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's one of the reasons that Dr. Cohn's death is so significant, and that his life was so significant, is because he made Black liberation theology, I think, accessible and central to so many people of faith in America. You know, when he talks about like why he wrote it, right, is he said that he was influenced both by Martin Luther King Jr. and by Malcolm X. And he saw that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were much closer to one another than a lot of people saw. And for him, the sort of the society where racism was no more had to go through what he called the sort of the land of the history that we don't tell enough, which is the history of Black brutality. And so for him, he was very clear that that every American Christian who wanted to know God, who wanted to know Jesus, had to go through this experience of reading the Bible from the perspective of those who are on the margins of society. And I think that's what was so beneficial from Black theology. The other thing that was really beneficial, and the other reason I think that a lot of other non-Black folks can access a Black theology of liberation, is that it laid the groundwork for other forms of liberation theology to exist. So one of the cases that Dr. Cone made in Black liberation theology, and that he fought with sort of classical white Christian theologians, you know, we have to know, right, that Dr. Cone wrote his PhD dissertation on Karl Barth. And so he was classically trained Western German theology, but he argued with them because he argued that all theology was particular. They argued that all theology was universal, but he says that out of his particular theological experience, then you can say something universal about God. And so he laid the groundwork for Black liberation theology, but also a lot of feminist theology, a lot of womanist theology, a lot of queer theology. A lot of these other marginalized groups were building on this work that valued the particular experience of an individual or of a group as a place for sort of discourse about God. And I think that that's another reason that so many folks can benefit from reading him, from studying him, and from paying attention to his work.
Mm-hmm. What's the text that you think, if people have no experience reading his work, what do you think they should start with?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think all of his work is really good, but I think I would start with The Cross and the Lynching Tree, because I think in The Cross and the Lynching Tree, you get a summary of who he is and why he initially set out to write both, his Black theology of liberation. But then you also get a bit of the 20th century problems too. So the first books, Black Theology and Black Power, Black Theology of Liberation and God of the Oppressed, they're all really rooted in this sort of post-civil rights, urban American crisis where Black power is a thing and where people are rioting because they're angry. The thing, and I think that's important to revisit and to see, but the thing that's really good about The Cross and the Lynching Tree is that he wrote this book because, and started to write this book as America talked more about the war on terror. And he wrote the book so that he could revisit and reframe that, like, terrorism wasn't new for some Americans. And he hoped that if white folks could see the terrorism that Black folks were under, that our theological solutions to the terrorism that we all collectively face might could be more robust. So I think it's a really good sort of comprehensive study of his work. And in the particular, writing is really beautiful. And I think he deals with some new questions too that he doesn't deal with in the text. And I'll just say that really quickly. One of the questions that he deals with is how to do life together in a Black and white Christian America. Mm-hmm. And he sort of ends the book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, on what The Cross and the Lynching Tree can teach us about life together in a multiracial, multicultural USA.
Fantastic. Kind of coming full circle in a way to answer the critique famously voiced by King that the most segregated hour of America is church time on Sunday morning. So a valuable resource really for all Christians. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Can I just read a quick part of that?
Absolutely, please.
So that folks can hear. And again, it's not the most important part of the book, because he really tells the history of lynching, and he pays attention to lynching in a way that very few people had done before. And it's really ironic that, Amy, that he passed on this Saturday, when Thursday and Friday in Montgomery Bryan Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative opened up a lynching, a memorial. And so his passing is a reminder to some people of the same way that W.E.B. Du Bois passed on the eve of the civil rights movement. You know, the ancestors crossing over as these big milestones happen. But when he, but when it comes to lynching, this is what he says at the end of The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And I want your listeners to get to hear this. The cross of Jesus and the lynching tree of Black victims are not literally the same, historically or theologically. Yet these two symbols or images are closely linked to Jesus' spiritual meaning for Black and white life together in what historian Robert F. Handy called Christian America. Blacks and whites are bound together in Christ by their brutal and beautiful encounter in this land. Neither Blacks nor whites can be understood without fully reference to the other because of their common religious heritage, as well as their joint relationship to the lynching experience. What happened to Blacks, and this is where he gets really profound, also happened to whites. When whites lynched Blacks, they were literally and symbolically lynching themselves, their sons, their daughters, cousins, mothers, and fathers, and a host of other relatives. Whites may be bad brothers and sisters, murderers of their own Black kin, but they are still our sisters and brothers. We are bound together in America by faith and tragedy.
Wow.
And so he sort of ends it there of, like I said, trying to make sense of what it means to be, to live together and to be theologically bounded together.
We are blessed to have had his work. And we are blessed to have had you join the podcast to talk with us about it.
Definitely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To wrap up the show, we are introducing a new segment we call Praise and Petitions, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and call out the people and situations who are making us cranky. I'm going to start off this week, if that's okay.
Please do. Please.
So, bringing me joy this week, I want to praise Trader Joe's salty caramel gelato. And I'm not sure whether to praise or call out my mom for stocking their refrigerator with it in their home in Michigan, which is how I discovered this exists. It is fantastic. And even as somebody who is lactose intolerant, I will not tell you how much of it I have eaten in the last few weeks without getting sick.
Wow.
So I don't know if this is a good or a bad thing. Yes, but it is delectable. It is cheap because, of course, it's from Trader Joe's. And
I miss Trader Joe's.
Yeah. We happen to have a very nice, like, legit Argentine gelato place here down the street.
Ooh.
But a tub of this from Trader Joe's, actually just as good.
We'll do just fine.
So cheaper. So that's making me extremely happy these days. Also making me happy, I have to give praise for the 80 degree weather we have right now. This morning, Cormac and I stopped at the lake on our way to his school, and it was so delicious to be able to just stick our toes in Lake Michigan. It's a little too cold to swim right now, but as Cormac said, "Ooh, it's refreshing, Mama." Which was just what we needed. And lastly,
so
my last praise is going to be for the growing number of manufacturers and outlets who are saying they're no longer going to sell or make guns.
Yes.
Just today, it was announced that Vision, which I guess is an outdoor company, is going to stop making guns. They were under pressure 2 months ago. REI said, "We're not taking any more orders from Vision." And Vision sells them lots of outdoor stuff, not just firearms. But REI said, "That's it. Nope. Our contract's all over until you stop making guns." And so they did. Another company that had announced something similar a couple of months ago, Dick's Sporting Goods, has now said it'll not only stop selling guns, it is going to melt down the semi-automatic guns that it had in its stock.
Wow.
So that they can't end up in any hands, which I'm going to give some praise to. That makes me awfully happy. But this is called Praise and Petitions. So for my petition, I want to call out the men, particularly in evangelicalism, like Paige Patterson of the Southern Baptist Convention, about whom there has been a lot written this week. Writings of his, I think, were turned up from within the past few years, in which he talks about counseling women who are being abused by their husbands, and says he never would and he never has counseled a woman to leave her husband. In fact, a woman came to him, said she was being emotionally abused. He sent her home to pray about her husband and pray that he would come to God. She came back to him with two black eyes, having been beaten by her husband. And he was happy to see this. Paige Patterson was, because it meant that her husband was going to see the error of his ways. In fact, he did come to church and say, "Oh my, I've done wrong," which, you know, isn't at all, and I'm being sarcastic here, the pattern of abusers, the remorse followed by more abuse. And the essential idea was, it's good for women to absorb abuse as a means of bringing their husbands to God, or if it ends up being a way that brings their husbands to God, reducing women to being less than human, to being just utilitarian, and the important thing being a man's soul. So for our petition this week, for the toxic theology that preaches abuse and the enabling of abuse and the acceptance of abuse, oh, we pray to be delivered. Lord, hear our prayer.
Indeed. Patriarchy is poison. That's what I have to say about that.
Snish, what about you?
Okay, praise and petitions. Let's see. Praise is that it is Avengers Infinity War season. I have not seen it yet, and so therefore, that leads me to my petition. If any of you spoil this movie for me, you will be dead to me. No more relationship for you. Although, based on Twitter and just like some of the responses to people's viewing of Avengers Infinity War, it is quite something to behold. So I'm excited to see it. I can't wait to see it. Another thing that I have been loving is my book that I recommended, The Female Persuasion by Meg Wurlitzer. Almost done with it.
And, how is it?
Oh, it's so good, Amy. It's so good. It's so good. So here's what I'm going to do. I have had a lot of people ask, hey, when are you going to talk about The Female Persuasion on the pod? And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to up the ante a little bit. If you would like to hear my unfiltered thoughts and join in the Impolite Book Club, I will create a post that if you are a patron of our Patreon community, you can come and listen to Book Club. So make sure you go sign up and we can talk about The Female Persuasion later on next week. That is one thing that I love. I have to talk about the weather too here in central Idaho. It's finally warming up, Amy.
Is the snow gone?
The snow is melted. The snow is melted, which means internet is on the way.
Praise
they be. They just have to drill under the street and run the line to our house, but they couldn't do that until the snow melted and the ground wasn't frozen. So it has been awesome. Weather has turned. It's like in the 60s. The kids have been wanting to go to the skate park and ride their bikes and jump on the trampoline, and I am so happy. So spring is on the way. It is a great, great time to live in Idaho. So that is my other praise. Okay. That is all this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. And if you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so that we can continue to expand these conversations. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.